In this interview, Gregory Jaffe draws on his experience working at the US Department of Agriculture to walk us through the often complex regulatory pathways governing cellular agriculture, novel meats and dairy. Gregory unpacks how oversight is shared across US agencies, which agency is responsible for what, and why transparency is good for business. What should innovators expect at each stage of review? If you're contemplating engaging with the process, this is a great place to start. I'm Alex Crisp, and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. You can listen to all episodes for free across podcast providers. Please subscribe and like. So thank you, Gregory Jaffe, for coming on to Future of Foods Interviews. Gregory is founder and president of Jaffe Policy Consulting. You are, or have been also, senior advisor to the USDA and the FAO. So you know your onions. Can you just introduce yourself quickly and so tell us a little bit about what you do there at Jaffe Policy Consulting?
So, well, thank you, Alex, and thank you for inviting me on this podcast. My consulting business is the most recent part of my career, and really it's helping industry, NGOs, associations, anybody who wants to hire me, to help them sort of navigate the regulatory and policy space. To help them come up with regulatory strategies, stakeholder engagement, to help them think about how do they move their products from the research to the commercial stage, and what do they think need to do, and what kinds of policies would be helpful to them. So help them navigate that policy landscape, primarily in the U.S., but also internationally. As you said, I've worked with FAO and others. I think that, you know, my background is that I've spent the last 30 years of my career working in and around Washington, D.C. As you said, I worked most recently in the government, in the Secretary's Office at USDA. But early in my career, I worked in the Department of Justice and EPA. I've also worked in the NGO community, particularly at the Center for Science and Public Interest. And I've always been at this intersection of new technologies and how do laws and regulations adapt to new technologies? How do we adapt and make our laws malleable to address these new technologies and these new products? And I started originally in the environmental space and moved more to that food and ag space over years, particularly with biotechnology, initially with genetically engineered crops, but then moved into things like cultivated meat, cloned animals, and now you get into other kinds of things like methane-reducing feed additives and a host of different products and biostimulants, a host of different products that sort of test those boundaries of new products, new methods of producing those products that don't sort of fit in traditional laws and regulations. And how do we address that?
Okay, so you work for the regulator, now you work for industry. I mean, are you advising cultivated meat companies on how to kind of speed up the process or how to kind of navigate the process? I know that the regulatory process can be quite complicated. So is that the sort of work that you do?
That is one of the things I can do. Yes, clearly help companies such as a cultivated meat company or others think about what is the regulatory pathway for their product, and how best to go about going through that regulatory pathway, when to engage with the regulators, when to engage with other stakeholders that could build support for your product, when to publish your research or your studies that show the safety of those products, how to brand your product and think of your product so that it doesn't impact its regulatory process. In many of our laws in the United States, the regulations and the laws are based on intent. Do you intend this product to be eaten? Do you intend this product to kill a pest? You know, if it's to be eaten, then it's food and regulated by the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. If you intend it to kill a pest, it becomes a pesticide. Now, there are many things that could kill a pesticide, but you don't commercialize them as being intended to kill a pesticide. And so, but if you put in that word somewhere in your brochure that this will kill a pest, then all of a sudden you've got to regulate it at EPA. Similarly, you know, for a food, if you claim that it has a health benefit to it, Well, then you may have to have additional regulation to prove that health benefit. You can't just put a health benefit that something's, good for your heart or reduces the likelihood of heart disease, for example, without some data behind that. So companies may think in their initial stage that it's good for them to put out all these claims or suggest this stuff, but it may come back to haunt them on the regulatory side if, in fact, they don't later have the data or evidence to do that, and it might increase their regulatory timetable and the regulatory burden. So what I help sometimes companies to do is to think through those things and think, how can I commercialize my product? How can I think about it? And if I think about the regulatory loop hurdles at the same time, I can sort of, how you design for, efficiency. Well, you could also design for regulatory efficiency. You might choose a particular microorganism for your fermentation that FDA is very familiar with, and it's been used historically for, brewing beer or some other food situation, and therefore isn't going to raise safety questions. Or you could use a new microorganism that hasn't been used before. That might be company's preferred organism, but that might raise all kinds of regulatory safety red flags and just make the process longer. And so, I can help companies think through those things and think about, well, what's the burden to the commercial change to move to a different organism versus the burden to the regulatory pathway if you use that particular organism. So I think, one of the things I try to think about is how does looking at regulation and how does that fit into your commercialization process?
So you were saying that it's about intent. So if you mentioned health benefits, is it if you say that your food has health benefits, if it's a plant-based food, for example, would that make the regulation more complicated? Is it more beneficial to sort of not mention the health benefits at the point of kind of seeking regulatory approval and then just then letting people find out perhaps that it has health benefits through their own sort of research. Does that, I mean, is that a pathway that you might recommend?
Yes, it is a pathway. Again, the devil's in the details. What is your health claim? How are you making that health claim? But if you make a specific health claim, then you do jump into a different regulatory pathway that does require some showing of that too, because otherwise the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act, but again, I'm talking about the US. Each country might be different, but in the United States, your labeling must be true and accurate. Not misleading. And so, there is potential that FDA will scrutinize any information you put on your label. And if you are beginning to make certain claims, and that does not just health claims, but if you say your product is, has less sodium in it than its conventional counterpart or things like that, there are regulations around when you can use certain terms and what your product has to, the composition of your product to get to that. But similarly, in the health arena, if you are making specific claims, that this product, prevents bronchitis or something like that, that's a very specific health claim, and you're going to be asked, well, what is your basis for that? And they're going to want to see a reasonable basis for that before they're going to let you put that on the on your label.
So, and I mean, to what extent is regulation, food regulation kind of, self-regulated with the GRAS statement, with the kind of generally recognized as safe? To what extent is that kind of self-regulation?
So I need to give a little background just so everybody understands. So the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was written a long, long time ago, and it's been, amended a number of times over the years, but still, it's an old statute, and so we take that, and we've over the years, FDA's interpreted that, the courts have interpreted that, and so under the law, food additives need to be approved by FDA. And there's a long process to improve food additives. And there's a long definition of food additives, but in general, it's anything new added to food. So it could be a new food ingredient, it could be a new food itself that hasn't been in the food supply. And I forget the date, whether it was 1953, if it already been in the food supply, it was grandfathered in. We call it grandfathered, meaning that it was already assumed to be safe to some extent because we had already been eating it. And so if your ingredient is something that was existent in the food supply before 1953, you're fine. Otherwise, if it's a new, it's called a food additive, and you need to get it approved. And that's a mandatory pre-market approval process that takes a number of years. But in that definition of food additive, it also says, unless, except products which are generally recognized as safe. And then it talks about how to prove that generally recognized as safe. It has to be based on publicly available data and an independent body of scientists who can show that this product it ha it is safe. And so there's this loophole or this exception. So think about it as all new foods have to be our food additives and have to be approved. But then there's some subset of those that are generally recognized as safe and would be exempted from doing that. And that's all the statute says. And so what FDA has said over the years, and it's changed over the years, was first they required companies to come in and show that their products were generally recognized as safe. And then, I don't know, way back in the 90s or something like that, they introduced a process that said, we're not going to, it was too much work for them and so forth. And they said, we're not going to do that anymore. You can self-affirm that your product is generally recognized as safe. And they put out guidance. Again, you have to have this independent panel of experts. It has to be based on publicly available data. So it can't be your own private studies. It has to be in the public record, meaning, scientific journals or published in other places. And if you do that, you can self-affirm that you're generally recognized as safe. They also allowed a voluntary notification process. So they said, but if you still want to come to FDA, you can come on a voluntary basis. You could submit a notification of GRAS status. We'll review that and we'll give you a no action letter. We'll give you an action that's a letter that says, we've looked at your application and we see no questions at this time about your determination that this food is GRAS. You're responsible for safe food. Under the law, anybody who sells food is responsible for ensuring that that food is safe, and the FDA can come in after you if that food is what the word is adulterated in any way. If it has a pathogen in it, if it makes anybody sick or anything like that, that would be considered adulterated. And so you have this GRAS process, and to some extent, because the food additive process is so. There's so much regulation associated with it. Many would say it's onerous. It takes multiple years. In the end, FDA actually issues a regulation. And the regulation says for this food additive, and let's give an example like aspartame or saccharin, an artificial sweetener, it says you can use this food additive in the following kinds of situations because food is also how is it being used? What's the percentage of it in a food? How much are we eating it in our diet? And GRAS is also, it's all about a particular use of it. But they would issue a regulation. And that takes a long time. So many companies and the industry has moved to wherever possible, fitting their new ingredients into the GRAS process. So when you ask, is it voluntary? There are, yes, you can self-affirm your GRAS. Now I'm going to tell you sort of the reality, the practicality of it. If you're a new food company or a new ingredient company or somebody who has a new food that would be a food additive, but it meets within the GRAS exception, you can self-affirm GRAS, and that's not a problem. That's legally sufficient. You always run the risk that FDA could come after you, but same thing if you notified FDA of the GRAS. But I can tell you from experience that if you want to sell that food to Kellogg or to Heinz or to General Mills or any major food company, they're not going to accept your ingredient unless you have the FDA number that says, and the letter that says FDA reviewed your GRAS notification process. So many, many food additives that are accepted as GRAS, many of them go through the voluntary notification process at FDA because they want to be able to have that credibility, that trust with the industry and consumers that they've done everything they could do within the regulations to ensure the safety of their food. And in fact, that opens the market to them. Now, there are others who don't care about marketing their ingredient or their product to those major companies, and they might have their own marketing scheme. They might be marketing it on the internet. They might be doing other things. And so they are comfortable with the self-affirmation of grass. And many companies self-affirm grass initially, because that's quicker. And then they also submit the application to FDA while they're continuing to test it, test the product in with consumers, build markets. You know, they might have a limited release. So they might do both. And there's, again, nothing wrong with doing both. Only problem is if you said it was grass and FDA came back and said, we have a question, then that does hurt your credibility as a company. So I'm sorry if I've given a long answer. One more thing, I just will make one more thing. So when we talk about cultivated meats and where they're regulated at FDA, that is a type of grass process. And similarly, when we talk about like biotech crops that have been regulated at FDA, that is also a voluntary notification process that fits within this general rubric of the grass process. Those are not mandatory foods. And we can think of these grass substances as not really new foods all the time, but new ways of producing the same food, if that makes sense. And so, you know, you might say, you know, let's take casein or whey, which are dairy ingredients found in milk that are now being produced through precision fermentation, through genetically engineered organisms and precision fermentation. So, you know, humans have been eating casein and whey for a long, long time, centuries, as long as they've been having cow's milk to a large extent. So now producing them in a different pathway, the molecules are the same. And so the safety profile to some extent is the same. The difference is the production process. And so those are a good candidate for being generally recognized as safe because they're not something new to the food supply. They're something that's been in the food supply for a long time, but it's a new production method for doing that. It's a new way. And the question is, are there new risks introduced from that new production process? And so they go through the generally recognized as safe category because there's a body of evidence showing humans digest casein, you know, blah blah, you know, so forth and so on. It's not an allergen, things like that. But the method of production requires it to ensure that it's still safe.
So where at the moment does the regulator sit on these kind of cultivated products? I mean, if the processing is different, then are they not kind of requiring everybody to go through the kind of longer approval stage?
So if we're talking about cultivated meat, self-cultivated
Cultivated.
meat,
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about Blue Nalu because they've been kind of waiting for years, haven't they, for their tuna to be approved.
so cultivated meat is a complicated but transparent regulatory process. So at the in the US at least, we have two agencies that regulate our food supply. We have the US Department of Agriculture, which regulates meat and poultry under the Meat Inspection Act and the Poultry Production Act. And FDA regulates all of the other foods in our food supply under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So people think generally it is about 80% of our food supply is regulated by FDA, about 20% of our food supply is regulated by USDA. So what happens when we have a cultivated, cell-cultivated meat product? And the two agencies got together and decided that FDA had some expertise in ingredients. Remember, USDA regulates meat. They regulate whole, they go to slaughterhouses and regulate the processing and packaging of meat, okay, of chickens and cows and everything else. They don't do things at the subcellular level. They're not looking at things at the cellular level. But you and I know that cell-grown meat is really done at the cell level, and you have different serums and different things coming in. And so they decided that FDA would regulate the production of these products up until they start processing those products. And that was because FDA had some expertise in that area. And so companies that are producing cell-cultivated chicken need to first go to FDA, and that's a voluntary, quote unquote, voluntary process. And I'll get to that in a minute. where FDA can look at their cell line and make sure there aren't any problems with the cell line that they've developed, and that their serum, look at the ingredients and the process and make sure, you know, we're not putting too much hormone or something that might have a or an allergen or something like that, something that might have a food safety effect at the cellular level, at the molecular level. Okay. And then USDA takes over, and USDA regulates the slaughtering. You know, they go into meat processing plants, and so they consider that bioreactor and that where you're producing this to be the meat processing plant. And so as you begin to harvest that and process it, that's when, and label it, that's when USDA takes over. Now, USDA's regulation is mandatory. So as opposed to FDA, where I said if it's a food additive, it's mandatory, but all the other things, grass, are not mandatory. At USDA, everything is mandatory. You cannot produce a meat or poultry-based food product without USDA's blessing. And so they do things like grant of inspection to your, you can't produce it at a facility unless there's a USDA inspector there, and unless the USDA inspector has given you a grant of inspection. You can't label your product unless USDA has approved the label. So the two statutes are very different. So if we have that cell-cultivated chicken, while the FDA process is theoretically voluntary, the USDA process is mandatory. And I can tell you, having worked in USDA, USDA is not going to mandatorily approve your product if you haven't gone to FDA. So in this one instance, you don't really have an option of self-affirming your production process for the initial part. You have to go to FDA. And so that's why this one's a slightly different process, and we've had it. Now, you mentioned Blue Nadal and their tuna. So USDA regulates catfish. That's the only fish species they regulate, and that's a whole nother story, but that's for political reasons, not for science or risk-based reasons necessarily. But FDA regulates all other food. So the if you do have a cell-cultivated fish or seafood product other than catfish, you don't go to USDA. The whole process from laboratory to selling the product will be regulated by FDA. And that process, they can go through that process. And I'm not sure that we've had a product that's gone through FDA's whole process yet. And that may be why Blue Nadal is waiting, as I think they may be the first of its kind. And unfortunately, first of its kind sometimes take longer to agencies to get comfortable with than the second or third of its kind. And that's just unfortunately the advantage of being first is you're first to market. You have certain advantages there, but you're also the first to the regulatory system, and that clearly is not an advantageous thing.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. Yeah, I really needed that education actually, because I have been slightly confused by how it works. So thanks for that. I mean, since the kind of chicken products were approved, I think in 2023, there hasn't been any products that have been approved, right? Apart from the fats, I know.
Well, there were two products that were approved this year. I think
One of
Mission
them,
Barnes's
Mission
fat was approved, and
Barnes.
also Believer Meats chicken was approved.
Yeah. Okay.
They had a grant of inspection issued, and their label was approved by USDA a few months before they folded as a company.
Nice.
But so there were two, and that was interesting because, you know, people thought, oh, well, gee, this is the Trump administration, and there are some parts of the meat industry that are not so favorable to cell-cultivated meat. I'm trying to be
Yeah,
nice with
diplomatic.
my language, diplomatic with my language. And so they thought maybe this new administration might not follow the science and make decisions not based on the science of whether these products were safe and their production facilities were, you know, following all the standards and so forth, but they might delay or you know, indefinitely delay decisions or come up with negative decisions. And we saw two decisions come sort of in the normal course of government business. And I think that was interesting to some stakeholders and showed that, you know, while we may have some big changes government-wide in terms of some of the principles and some of the ways, some of the public policies, both in the food and ag space, that when it came down to regulating individual products, at least for this particular regulatory system for cell-cultivated meat, it seemed to be business as usual. And I think that was positive that people, that was a positive response that these products were getting their, let's say, fair day. Normally we'd say their day in court,
Not
but we're
their
not in
perfect
court.
day.
But so they would get their fair review in the regulatory, a fair review. I'm not going to say in a timely manner. People would always say it should be quicker, but they got a decision.
Yeah. So how would, for example, how would milk be regulated in the USA? I mean, would that fall under the USDA?
No, so milk is a product that's regulated by FDA.
Okay.
So milk, that's right. So we have all kinds of weird things, you know. So cows are regulated, beef is regulated by USDA, but milk is regulated by FDA.
Okay.
Eggs, depending on what you do with your eggs, you could be regulated by both FDA and USDA.
Right.
Things get very, very complicated. And remember also, milk's interesting because milk also necessarily has some state level regulation, some state component regulations to milk, because milk has to be pasteurized and other kinds of things that are done. The date labeling of milk and other kinds of things are done sometimes at the state level. States have more regulation of milk than other food products necessarily. So you picked a more complicated one.
Right, okay. So how do you feel kind of generally? Do you think the US food regulatory system is fit for purpose, or do you think they could make improvements?
So, you know, I always describe the regulatory system, US regulatory system for food, as a work in progress. It's constantly a work in progress because it's always changing and adapting to new foods, to changes in pathogens, to novel risks. And so, you know, it's definitely not an ideal system. You know, if you were building a system today for food safety regulate for food regulation, I don't know that anybody would put 20% of it at USDA and 80% of it at FDA and set eggs in both situations and have cheese pizza regulated by one agency and pepperoni pizza regulated by a different agency. You know, nobody would ever think of doing that. Or and the idea that every meat and poultry plant gets inspected every day, but a fish or a plant-based, you know, a lettuce processing plant gets inspected once every 5 years. I mean, it's not necessarily a risk-based safe system in the truest sense, because we're not putting the resources necessarily where the risks are. It's where the laws have been. So I wouldn't, on one hand, I'd say, you know, it's a work in progress. But at the same time, I would say, you know, we have some of the safest food in the world in the US, and it's safer now than it was previously. You know, and I talked to Europeans all the time about our food safety, our food regulation system. And, you know, they think more highly of it because it's faster than their system, especially for these novel foods and so forth. And so I think about, well, what makes our system good? And I think there are several characteristics. One, I think on the whole, it is science and risk-based. We can find exceptions and things like that, but it clearly tries to follow the science and follow the risks and put its resources where risks are and put the regulation where risks are. So I think that's one. There's a lot of transparency. You can see the applications for cell-cultivated meat. You can see the decision that the agency made. There's obviously confidential business information that's redacted, but you can, and you can learn, therefore. A new company can look and say, well, I have a similar product. Let's see what other people put in their applications. And that saves a lot of you know, cost and effort and things like that. The third thing is that we have consultation. So companies can come in and consult with FDA and sort of say, hey, here's this product. How is it regulated? What data do I need to do? And so, you know, I was shocked that the European system doesn't have that same kind of thing. And that's really important. And also the agencies can consult with academics, they can have science advisory panels, they can sort of try their best to sort of keep up on the science. And then finally, I would say, you mentioned the milk example. You know, our regulatory system has good partnerships. The states and local governments have huge numbers of inspectors and things to help with our food regulation. The industry has, you know, best practices and things like that. You can't have safe food without industry really making that, you know, inspectors and the federal government and state can't be everywhere. So the industry has, a lot of incentives to have best practices. And we have stakeholders and others who also, employees who learn food safety and keep that. So I think of it in the end as, the federal government's part of sort of a village, and it takes a whole village to ensure safe food, federal, state, local, industry, employees, product developers, farmers, and their practices on the farm prevent pathogens. And so, everyone together makes the food system safe. So, is it fit for purpose? I don't know. It's what we have. Does it do its job? I think it does it fairly well. Could it be improved? Sure as hell.
Right.
But what I think is nice about it compared to Europe and other places is it does adapt. So we don't, in Europe, when you have these novel foods, they had to wait and do the European Commission had to write a regulation. We don't need to go back to our Congress, our legislators, every time. We figure out a way to adapt old laws to meet new technologies. I always say, it's fitting square pegs into round holes. It doesn't work really well, but it's a hell of a lot better than starting all over.
Yeah. It's so I mean you mentioned earlier about the administration, and I was kind of wondering what the sort of general sentiment is in the USA, kind of with the regulators versus the new administration. Is there any conflict there, or are they kind of mostly aligned, do you think?
You're talking about the employees versus the leadership, or are you talking about the industry versus
Yeah, so you were sort of
the
saying about the kind of new Trump administration, and kind of people are slightly sort of skeptical about whether some novel foods like cultivated meat would be approved. I mean, has the sentiment in the USA changed towards things like cultivated meat and plant-based foods? And is this, if it has, is this a political thing, or is this a kind of general sentiment? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that the Trump administration has clearly elevated food issues more than other administrations have. In the Food and Drug Administration, it's the Food and Drug Administration. Historically, the commissioner has been a doctor, and they primarily worked on drugs, and food was sort of like the stepchild, the Cinderella of the story, maybe. This administration and RFK Jr. as the head secretary of HHS has clearly elevated food issues and the MAHA movement and all these things about mandatory grass and food dyes and childhood obesity and trying to improve the health of our population through diet has elevated food issues tremendously. And I think on one level that's been very interesting to the public, and people are very, there are parts of that people really love, and there are other parts of that give them trepidation. And also there's a question about how much of that is rhetoric and how much of it will be implemented and how it will be implemented. And so I think there's a lot of sort of wait and see and sort of sitting on the sidelines for those kind of things. And so to some extent, cultivated meat and some of these newer technologies into food have almost taken a back seat. People don't talk about them very much because we're talking about wholesale changes to the way people eat and what's good to eat in your diet. And I mean, there's discussions about getting rid of seed oils or that seed oils are bad. There's discussions about whether you should eat more saturated fat or not less, more less saturated fat. How much meat you should eat. Some big picture items. And so my general sense is that the questions around some of these novel food technologies has really not risen to the same political discussions that might have happened in the last administration. That also could just be a product also of the fact that they're not really on the shelves yet, that some of those companies are having trouble with raising funds. And so we're not, I think those companies were also laying low for a little bit, but now they're laying low for other reasons. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I tried.
Well, I mean, I'm curious, I suppose, about the US states that have preemptively banned cultivated meats, and whether this is whether you think this is indicative of perhaps a kind of wider feeling in the US, or whether these are sort of outliers.
I think this year we'll actually be telling about that because I think that there are some states that have banned them and they've done it in the last few years. There are a number of proposals to continue those bans. Some of those bans are absolute, some of them are temporary, some of them are just bans for public funding, like for research and things in these areas. I think the meat industry initially, there are many, I don't want to take meat industry as monolithic. There are many stakeholders and people in the meat industry who felt that these new cultivated meats, for example, were a threat to them and that they should quash them and have these type of bans. And there were some states that were very favorable to that. More recently, in the past year, we saw a number of meat stakeholders who sort of said, no, it's more important to us to have free competition and that we're not scared of these products and that if you ban them, you're going against our view of less government and less government intervention in the marketplace. And those principles are more important to us than the principle of banning this. And so that's why I'm saying it'll be curious to see this year whether the trend continues with more bans or whether that other category of stakeholders is more vocal and says, hey, that isn't the role of that we want government to generally play in our marketplace, independent of the cell cult, whether it's the particular product, and therefore they lose the momentum. And I'm a little bit of that category. I think that's going to be the category that you're going to see less bans moving for passing of bans moving forward, that the tide has turned a little bit. And I think part of that is, when the cell cultivated meat industry started, they termed their food clean meat. I don't know if you remember back then, that was the initial phrase that many people were calling it. And the problem with that phrase was it put people on the defensive because if this meat was clean, well, what is all the other meat? Is it dirty meat? And so you made enemies. It was sort of like, if you come out fighting against me, I'm going to come out fighting against you. And I think if you see now today the branding of these products and the people who are working on it, they have a very different language that they use. And they talk about sustainable protein and they talk about coexistence. They talk about this supplementing the initial meat supply, that we need more protein, we need more animal protein, and we can have both. We're not going to reduce the number of cows. We're going to prevent the increase in the number of cows to meet the worldwide demand. And so I think that language has also caused people to lower the temperature on this discussion. It's not an either or. It's not us versus them, but it's how do we all work together to improve diets? How do we all work together to improve sustainability? And there's a lot of people in the meat industry. We have these methane reducing feed additives. We have all kinds of things coming online to reduce the footprint of meat production that also is favorable. So I think people look at it as how do we do all of it better as opposed to how does one replace the other? And I think that's changed, I think, some of this discussion also around these bans.
I mean, clearly there's more of an appetite for a sort of collaborative approach between the meat industry and kind of alternative meat. And I've seen conversations where even the use of alternative meat is kind of pushed away for more of a collaborative, inclusive, sort of additive to meat, like like the likes of the kind of Better Meat company. It's not there to replace, it's there to sort of add to. So I was wondering, when a new company comes to you, like a startup company, for advice for you to help them with the kind of regulatory process, what's some of the earliest sort of tips or advice you might give a company like that? What are some of the mistakes that they could make if they sort of tried to do this on their own?
So I think there are a couple of things that I think are really important to consider for new startups. One is I realize that they're always, their first job is coming up with a proof of concept and then showing that it can be scaled. And I completely understand the both the science and technical issues around those things and why that is. They have to be ultra focused on eventually a product that can get to market. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, they need to think about regulatory strategy and stakeholder engagement early on, because that can help them later on with the process. And the time spent at the early stage can prevent longer process at the back end, when it may be costing them a lot of money to be sort of idle and not doing anything. And as I said, I think it's where I think people, industry, new companies make mistakes sometimes, is they complete their whole development process and also their sort of production process without thinking enough about the regulatory policy issues around that. And they may, in fact, lock themselves into regulatory hurdles that they might have avoided had they thought, had a consultant like myself come in, look at their product, look at their method of production, look at their business plan, and say to them, hey, if you tweak this part of the business plan, or if you decide if you could use this organism or do this slightly differently, and you might save yourself a lot of heartache and a lot more questions when it gets to the regulatory process. And I want companies to sort of think of regulation as enabling. It helps them. It is a stage that helps prove their product to investors, prove their pocket to consumers. It gives them free PR. Every time you have a regulatory hurdle that you overcome, you have a PR event, you get press around it and things like that. And so I think a lot of people look at regulation as negative. And I like to work with companies to sort of figure out how we can take regulation, which I understand is burdensome and time consuming and costly, and turn it into a positive and an enabling part of your business plan. And work with, in the interim, while you're doing that, work with stakeholders and build support for the product, build a marketplace for the product. So, as we said with the cultivated meat, it was like the industry picked a certain phrase, and all of a sudden you had a lot of enemies who were trying to stop you. If you think about the phrases you use, think about the intent, what you how you characterize your product. You may want to characterize it one way for funders, but you also might lock yourself into, again, certain regulations by the kinds of claims you make. And so having somebody like myself work through these things with a company can help them avoid those mistakes and put themselves on the shortest, most efficient pathway to market, I think.
Yeah, I actually have a regulatory background myself. I used to work for Ofcom as a senior investigator for there, so I kind of understand the process. We used to do sort of case adjudications and that sort of thing. So and so to a degree, how quickly you get your products approved. How much would you say is about your relationship with the regulator, and how much is it about actually kind of getting your documents right? Because, I mean, if we think about, for example, the COVID vaccines, when they put their mind to it, they can do something very quickly. So it can be as quick or as slow as possible, kind of depending on how urgent it is. So, I mean, is there an argument to say it's about kind of having a good relationship with the regulator?
Clearly, it's very important, and something I do in my consulting practice is help make those relationships, not just with the regulators, but with the legislators, your state senators or your congresspeople, again, with other stakeholders. If you have support behind your product, it doesn't necessarily change the scientific analysis that the agencies make, but it clearly helps move it a little higher up on the pile, and it gives it a little more impetus to go. If you know that it's going to create jobs, if the marketplace is clamoring for this, if it's a product that's going to compete with China, a host of different things. So depending if it's going to improve sustainability, if it's going to improve farmers' income, there's a host of things that you can build support for. So I think it is important when you're going through the regulatory process to build support with other stakeholders. But I think, you say, is it the data more important or the relationship more important? I sort of say you can't get the data right completely, especially particularly for a novel product, without talking to the regulators. I mean, you don't want to sort of just make it up on your own and interpret the guidances, old guidances to new situations. One could do it. I could help them do it. We probably could do a decent job, but it's better to ask, am I doing this right before I spend all this time doing it? If I do it this way, will that be likely to be satisfactory for you? And so to some extent, what I also do is help make those relationships with the regulatory actors and help prepare the company for having those meetings so they can get useful information that will help them, again, make their regulatory process more efficient and more less costly and things like that. But I think, I mean, what was most telling, Alex, you're in, I guess, the UK, you're not in Europe, but I was in a panel earlier last year with somebody from EFSA. And the gentleman there said that 60% of their applications get rejected as insufficient. And then in the next sentence, he said, and we don't allow them to consult beforehand. And I sort of said, what's wrong with this process? If you're rejecting 60% of your applications, think about all the sort of resources being misused here. And so, that's why. So I think you've got to, they have to come together to some extent, especially particularly for novel things. If there are things that have obviously very similar to things that have gone through, and today if you do another, BT corn application, having how many BT corns do we have out there? You don't need to go. You know what data you need. You know what analysis you have to do. You don't have to spend a lot of time with the regulators beforehand to put in your application for a new BT corn variety. Do you know what I'm saying? But if it's something that's truly novel, I think that that's a critical step.
Yeah, I have done a little bit of work with EFSA. They have very strict processes, and the idea of the carrot and the stick with the regulator, they kind of start with the stick, and perhaps arguably that's perhaps what's going wrong there. So as a last question, Greg, if you could change anything with the regulatory system there in the US, what would you suggest to make it more effective?
So, I mean, if you look at the system in a broad way, I think it's obviously pretty good. When you start getting into the details, there are obviously lots of things that I think could be changed. I'm not a big fan of self-affirmed GRAS. I think the whole plant process is moving to mandatory GRAS. I think that's the better way for trust and for ensuring food safety. And I don't think the burden has to be anymore, but it could be depending on other factors. I think, again, I think we're pretty good at risk assessments and a risk-based system. I think that, the most critical thing for industry and for consumers, really, because they also want new and better products all the time in the marketplace, is the need to go through the process in a timely fashion. I think, people care most about, the industry cares most about certainty and predictability. And I think that's where, and especially new startups and things like that, if you don't know if you're going to get a decision in 6 months or 18 months or 3 years, you have to have cash on hand. You have to keep your business operating while you're waiting, things like that. I think that is the thing that really holds people up. So, if I was asked, the biggest change of the system is almost not a legal change. It's not a process change. It's really making sure we have the right resources, the number of people, and that we do have a system that is has certainty and predictability associated with it. The predictive, that, and both of those involve science-based decisions, transparency, so you know what data you need, but then also a decision in a reasonable period of time that people can then calculate into their business plans and so forth. I know that's not a the easiest thing to do in the current administration, where they're trying to cut back on government and the number of people in government. But I think, to me, the payoff is tremendous if you can get regulatory decisions in a timely fashion. I think everybody wins.
Yes, it's the complaint they make in the UK as well about the kind of Food Standards Agency, that there's just not enough people working there. So kind of more resources, obviously more money, and yeah, it's the same kind of problem in the UK. So anyway, thank you, Gregory, for coming on the Future of Foods interviews. That has been very illuminating. I look forward to meeting you actually next month. And yeah, thank you again.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, and I do look forward to meeting you in person and participating in the conference next month. And I would just also say to your listeners, if there's other things I can do, I'm on LinkedIn, and people can feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy to, set up an initial consultation or initial conversation to see if I can be of help.
Brilliant. Thank you.